Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Controller Club, the Friendly Face Gaming Space, a podcast where three friends from three continents share in one love, and that is video games. My name is Klein Felt, and alongside me today, I've got a very special guest on our hands today, folks. I've got one of my best friends in the whole wide gaming world coming to us from across the pond, the Chocobo Tamer here on the podcast. It is Tom Drew. Tom, how are you? How are things? Are you excited? We're talking about Final Fantasy VII today. It's happening.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, coming right to you through the live stream of the planet. It feels weird because, like, yeah, this game came out like what, almost 2 months ago now, and I've only now just finished it, but yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts, so I'm ready to jump into this.
It's funny, just the little peek behind the production curtain here, folks listening. Tom finishes the game the other day. We're talking about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth here today, doing a full spoiler cast. I get a message at 3:30 in the morning his time saying, I finished it and I have thoughts. Do you want to do a podcast? So I was like, sure. So this is a special bonus episode. We will still have our regularly scheduled episode this week. It'll be me and Lauren. We're going to be talking about some of our favorite games left in 2024 that still haven't come out that we're still anticipating. But for now, we are going to talk about Final Fantasy VII. But before we get to that, I want to introduce our very first guest here on Controller Club, a very special guest today, gaming editor at Mobile Syrup, and our very own materia keeper for today, the Final Fantasy VII lore master himself, Brad Shankar. Brad, how are you? And welcome to the show.
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I feel especially honored being the first guest that you guys have had. Listen every week and really enjoy it. And I'm a big Seven nut, so I'm excited to dive right in.
It's funny. We've been talking about, we wanted to get guests here on the show for a little while. And so Tom, when he hit me up and he's like, we need to do a spoiler cast. And I was like, can I message Brad? There's one person in my life who knows more than Final Fantasy or Final Fantasy VII particularly than anyone else I know, and that's you, Brad. So I'm happy you're here. Before we get to the nitty gritty of it all, I want to ask you, because you are our first guest, and this is something I want to do with all of our guests, what is your best gaming memory? I know a lot of podcasts like to ask, what's your favorite game? What was your first game? But I want to go back. I want to put the memory card in the cartridge a little bit and ask you, what is your best gaming memory? And does it have to do with Final Fantasy VII? Because I think it might, I don't know. I don't know your gaming history all that well.
Yeah, it does in a roundabout way. For me, for context, Final Fantasy is my favorite series. VII is my favorite game of all time. But I was introduced to Final Fantasy through Kingdom Hearts because, you know, those characters guest star in there. But I didn't even play the first Kingdom Hearts originally. It was the Chain of Memories on the GBA that I first played. And the reason I played it is...
Is that the one with the cards in it? It's like the deck building?
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason that was the one that I played first is because my best friend growing up, he bought the game because he heard from his brother, who heard from somebody on the school playing grounds, that the game included Inuyasha, because he was really big into that anime. I don't know where he heard that or where he thought that. I don't know if maybe he saw Riku on the cover because he's kind of got Inuyasha hair. But anyways, that's why he bought it. And then he ended up really liking it and he loaned it to me. And he had kind of moved away around this time, so we didn't see each other very often. So when I did get to see him, we were kind of bonding over Kingdom Hearts. And then I just remember being really obsessed with this character Cloud because he looks so cool. He's one of the best cards in that game when you use him in combat. And I'm like, okay, I want to learn more about him. And then my friend picked up Final Fantasy VII. He played it, gave it to me, and that was kind of my history at that. So it was kind of an interesting way of being introduced to Final Fantasy through Kingdom Hearts, but just having the fond memories of playing that with my best friend who had moved away and sort of bonding over it. And then I went back and played every Final Fantasy game after that. So a lot of fond memories there.
You saw that blonde hair and that big old Buster sword and you're like, I'm in. I don't know anything about this guy, but I want to know more.
I can't get over the Inuyasha thing. It reminds me of like people talking about Sonic and Melee and those sort of like childhood rumors. And that sort of thing. Like, that's hilarious.
You can play as Giga Bowser. Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into it. The Final Fantasy VII Rebirth spoiler cast. That's why you're here. We have all played the game. It is, as you said, Tom, it has been a couple months since the game came out. I think, Brad, you, of the three of us, finished it first. You actually reviewed the game for Mobile Syrup, correct?
Yeah, and they gave the code like a month early. So I actually, before doing this, I went back and watched a lot of videos and kind of some of the cutscenes again to refresh my memory because it has been a little while since I beat the game. I mean, I did beat it again on hard, but still, that was like a month and a half ago. So
yeah, it's it is funny though, because we are not like, Tom, you mentioned a couple months. This week, there are a couple notable podcasts I listen to that are doing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth spoiler cast. So I don't think, you know, I think we're as timely as we ever have been. So let's get into it. I want to start here before we get into like full spoilers and all of that. I just want to get your general thoughts, Brad, what you thought about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and what is your relationship to Final Fantasy VII as a whole? I mean, you teased it in your best gaming memory, but what does this series, what does this franchise within a franchise mean to you as a gamer?
Yeah, it's funny you asked that, because for the 25th anniversary in 2022, Square did a like hashtag what Final Fantasy VII means to me sort of thing, and people were sharing a lot of videos. So I wrote like a really long piece about my sort of relationship to that. But sort of the gist of it is, you know, I talked about how Cloud looked like the sort of coolest character ever. But the funny thing when you actually play the game is that he's a deconstruction of cool characters. He's very much a goofball in a lot of ways, and that's sort of what that game is about, him realizing that, you know, he's not the sort of cool person that he pretends to be. He's actually got a lot of insecurities, and so I really related to that character a lot for that reason. So that really kind of moved me in a lot of ways, that sort of connection to him in that arc, which is something the remake games are fleshing out way more, which is really cool. But for Rebirth specifically, it's incredible. I mean, it's everything I could have hoped for and more, pretty much. It's got everything that Remake did really well, but it doubles down on it. It cuts out a lot of the sort of padding that Remake had with a lot of the chapters that sort of were really bloated. I feel like the side quests are a lot better and more purposeful. We'll get into that later. The combat, all the little added flourishes, like improved aerial combat, more variety in the party members. The music is even better, which is hard to believe because the original game, the first game's soundtrack was phenomenal. Even the open world stuff, which has gotten some legitimate criticisms for being kind of tropey and sort of basic in a lot of ways. I like how that sort of evolves over time, where by the end of the later regions, there's actually sort of a thought process to how you have to navigate. Like, you have to climb up this wall and swing across this canyon and glide along this path with the chocobo sort of thing. So I kind of like how thought out it was in that sense. And yeah, it's such a great encapsulation of everything I love about Final Fantasy VII, that sort of goofy, campy tone with the sincere, heartfelt characters and storytelling. And it just captures that so well.
And how many hours would you say you have in this game?
When I got the platinum trophy, the little screenshot that the PS5 takes, it was 167 hours.
Wow. Okay. Tom, Drew, you just finished it. You're coming hot off the end of this game. We've kind of shared our thoughts over the last, I guess, couple months, weekly updates of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. But now that you've seen it, now that you've rolled credits, what do you think about this game as a whole?
Yeah, well, just before I get into fully what I think about it, in terms of like my relationship to FF7, like, I haven't played the original game, so my first experience with it was Remake. I have FF7, I have it on Switch, and I have, well, Lauren gifted me like this PlayStation Greatest Hits like version of the game, so I have the game twice technically, and I haven't played it yet. But yeah, I came to it with Remake, and that was kind of my first exposure to the franchise. I really loved it. There were some issues with it, like how kind of linear it was, and some of those different things. But going to Rebirth, I was super excited. And coming on the other side of it, I'm definitely conflicted. There are things that I genuinely love about the game. I think, like, in terms of the improvements to, like, gameplay and combat and exploration, like, all of that stuff I think is incredible. I think a lot of my reservations come to do with the story, and I there are moments that I really love, but, and we'll get into more, but my confliction with it a bit as we go on, I guess. But when I roll credits, I was sort of like, I like Climb Messenger, I messaged at 3 a.m. I was like, what the hell just happened? Sort of thing. Because it's a lot to unpack. And I think I have kind of come to terms with certain things, but I still think there are aspects of the game that I wish were kind of handled a little bit differently. But that is also coming as, you know, this is only 2/3 of the story that we've seen up to this point. We don't really know where they're going to fully go with the third part. I also I'm not as familiar with the original story as you guys are. So there is that kind of to it as well, I think. But overall, I would say, like, I really enjoyed my time with it. I mean, I put 80 hours in this game. How could I, like, come to the conclusion of, like, you know, come to the end of it and be like, I hated it. But no, I really loved it. I do have some quibbles that I think we need to go over.
For me, Final Fantasy VII was, I was introduced to it as well through, I guess not introduced to it through Remake, but it's the first experience I had actually playing with these characters. I knew Cloud, like, I'm a huge Smash Bros. Fan, so seeing Cloud and Sephiroth in Ultimate, I understand how big of a deal that was. I know how big the Buster's, like, I know how iconic the Buster Sword is and how iconic this story is. I have moments from the story in my head just from being a gamer. So I played Remake and enjoyed it fine, but I would not have, like, definitively called it one of my favorite games of all time. I think Rebirth is one of my favorite video games of all time. The longer I sit with it, I tweeted right when I finished it, and it was almost directed right at you, Brad, was, I understand why people love this world as much as they do coming out of Rebirth. Like, I understand why the Final Fantasy VII stand, why there are Final Fantasy VII stands from that original game. That first part in Remake, I got it, and I understood the characters and this and that. I fell in love with the characters in Rebirth. Like, this Cloud, Tifa, Aerith, Barrett, like, this Yuffie, like, this whole group is just so, and the dynamics between them is just so lovable. And I think that is, like, the best thing I can say about this game is just, like, that I was in it for 75 hours and every single story beat I was just, like, especially in the, like, the last half, like, any dialogue that said, I was giddy and, like, had tears in my eyes just because they were talking to each other. And I think it is so special. I can see why some people may have some issues with specifically the ending. I did, but the more I think about it, the more I gestate on it, the more I like it. And the more that, like, I think that this is a really great game to dissect and to talk about. I talked to Tom about this when I finished it. This is a game that I have not thought about the ending more since, or I have not thought about the ending of a game more since The Last of Us in 2013, where when I finished The Last of Us in 2013, I was like, whoa, like, I'm the bad guy. Like, what's going, spoilers for The Last of Us. It's been 11 years, but there's a TV show, but like I sat for hours and just tried to take in as much as I could of other people's opinions and video essays and reading and all these breakdowns. And that's what I did the second I finished Rebirth. I'm like, I need Maximilian Dude, queue up that 4-hour spoiler cast. I need, like, any person's opinion about the ending of this game. I need to hear it. And so I think that this is so, so, so special. I can't believe they made it. Like, it just, from a production value standpoint, is unmatched. There's just, you said, Brad, the music, the visuals, the story moment, like, it is just so, the open, like, it is just so massive and so big, and I mean that in a sense of, like, actual size and just, like, grandiosity. Like, every little thing feels so, so, like, overdramatic. And I love this game so much. I can't see a world in which this isn't my game of the year at the end of the year. But let's break down the spoiler wall. Let's do it. Let's, I'm trying to think of a limit break the spoiler wall. I guess we could go it. I want to ask you guys to get things started here, and we can dive in wherever we want. But I think that one of the really big, strong suits of this game is these major story moments. There are some truly, truly spectacular things. And so I want to ask you guys, what was maybe your favorite chapter of the game, your favorite portion to go through? Tom, you're the most recent off of it. So what was your favorite now that you've done all 14 chapters? Was there a chapter that stood out to you as kind of your favorite?
Yeah, There's a lot of them, to put it bluntly. Like, there's so many. The thing with this game is, like, the first game is remake is a lot more linear, like it's more focused on that story. This is a lot more character focused, like practically like a lot of the chapters are like very like, okay, we're gonna do Red 13's chapter now, or we're gonna do Barrett's chapter now. We get a bit more of their like backstory, which I really appreciate. Like, I think that's like what you need in a game like this to like really build up, like we've built up the relationships a bit, but now let's dive deep into like what makes these characters tick a bit more. In terms of favorites, like it's very hard to choose. I think like I do like chapter 12. I mean, that's obviously the date chapter, like where you go on, you built up your relationships with like your characters. It's incredible. I love the way that culminates in like the dance and all that stuff. But weirdly enough, I think one of my favorites, and it's not like too impactful of a chapter necessarily. And I think it is like weirdly just because of the vibes. I just like the vibes. Chapter 7, where you're mostly just like exploring and you kind of going and climbing Mount Carell. It is a lot to do with that music. I think the Mount Carell theme is like one of my favorite tracks in the whole game, but I just love the character moments in that chapter. Like Yuffie like being motion sick, and you get to choose between the different like mine carts that you can choose, like to either make it like sick or like or have it like have a more gentle ride. But yeah, I think those two really stood out to me in terms of like favorite story moments. But there's so many to choose from.
Brad, are those two any of your favorites, or is there something else off the board that you would want to pick?
I love them all. I mean, my favorite would be 13, chapter 13, which Final Fantasy has a bit of a cursed history with the number 13. Even in in Remake, the chapter 13 was pretty bloated and a lot of padding. But in this game, it's like, so this is the Temple of the Ancients chapter, so the penultimate one. And I thought it was so brilliantly done, because like in the original game, the Forgotten Capital, which is the next chapter, is sort of the main source of tension, because, you know, you have this eerie alien sounding theme from Uematsu, and you're kind of running through it to find Aerith because you know she's in danger. They can't really do that again in this sense. There's obviously suspense with what's going to happen to her, but instead they kind of take that tension and suspense and kind of put it more into the Temple of the Ancients. Like, there's a much more haunting atmosphere to the temple this time around, where in the original game, it was sort of goofy. There's like these weird temple people who are wearing these like goofy hats, and they're dancing around, and the music's kind of more playful, but it's a lot more somber this time around. And I appreciate that they kind of split up the party. So you're kind of Barrett, Cloud, and Tifa are sort of in one group, and then the rest are in the other group, and you're sort of going back and forth between the two of them, and you run into different members of the Turks. You get to see a lot more of Cloud's psychotic breakdowns, particularly when he's about ready to kill Elena from the Turks, and they have to like stop him. You know, later on, you're chasing Aerith as Cloud, and it's like straight out of a horror movie, the way it's sort of like shot and framed, which is like, wow. But then on top of all that, just the incredible story and character moments, like I keep going back to my favorite part of the entire game, and probably of any game of the last several years, is when every character sort of goes through that crucible of, you know, confronting their trauma. I played through the game twice, like I said, and I bawled both times doing the Aerith part. Like, just it was so brilliant to take a character to take that character and sort of let you see Midgar from the perspective of this little sad girl who's trying to save her mother, and how harsh and unforgiving and uncaring that world is. And I was just bawling that whole time. It was just so well done. And for all the characters, because one of the main themes of the game is, you know, trauma and sort of overcoming it. And I think letting you inhabit the characters during those traumatic moments was so brilliantly done. Like, it's something I keep coming back to, is like, that's the standout moment of the game for me.
And it makes you buy into the whole party thing that is Final Fantasy. Like, you see that these characters are this found family for one another, and you get to go through each of those moments that kind of like put them onto this path towards coming together. And yeah, all of them pretty much are these like horrible, horrible things, but it brings together this what could be good thing, and people in their lives that they never thought they could be close to someone again, and now they are together and saving the world. And like, I think that, like, that sequence, those few moments, is like they're some of the best in gaming. It's just, it is so, so well done. When you enter that room for the first time and the doors open and you're looking around and I'm thinking, here we go. It's going to be like a one-on-one fight or like a trial for each of them. And it was not that at all. And I love that. I love that it is this, like these, each character gets its story, their story moment. And then we kind of bring them all back together again and head towards the end. I think that's so cool. Also very cool Temple of the Ancients sequence when it's all just crumbling and they're outside and it's like almost like shot like a horror movie. There's like these big punch zooms on Sephiroth and like Aerith falls and Cloud goes for. I think like that is all just like, that's when I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, clutching the controller with sweaty palms, going like, oh my gosh, especially knowing what's coming as a Final Fantasy fan, just like, but not knowing it super deeply. I'm like, what are they going to change? What's going to be different? Is this where it happens? Is this where Aerith gets killed? Like, I'm sitting there not really sure what's going to happen next. And I think like that whole portion of the game is so, so special.
Yeah, definitely.
My favorite chapter of the game is the Gungaga stuff. Like I think that my, like, we want to talk about favorite story moments. The whole Gungaga reactor sequence is, that's when I was like, this is an all-timer. Like, this is, I need to put my controller down and just like sit back for a second, because that whole, the way you go in there and it culminates in this confrontation between Cloud and Tifa, and he almost kills her, and then she falls and goes in the live stream, and that's when I was sitting there just like with my mouth agape thinking, how is this happening? I have goosebumps all over my body, I have tears in my eyes, like what is going on? Again, playing with expectations, I'm thinking, oh, are we doing this? Is Tifa dead? Like, are we doing this? Obviously we don't, but it, because they have set the precedent that like fate has been broken, changes can be made. I was worried, and I think that it was so well done. I took a screenshot of, there's a shot of Cloud during a cutscene looking up with a sword on the ground, looking up at the top of the reactor. And I'm like, this is just him thinking and internalizing about what he just did, just pushing Tifa off this ledge and she may never come back. It was just like, mwah, chef's kiss. It's so good.
Yeah, it's a crazy sequence. Like, you're just seeing this giant fish eating Tifa. But yeah, when you see it go through the live stream and it like, and brings you go on this journey with Tifa inside a giant fish, which like out of context sounds crazy, but it's really cool. And like just the scale of it, like obviously you see these like giant weapons kind of going like as the game goes on. But yeah, I was just kind of blown away by how like, yeah, the scale of everything and like how minuscule they make Tifa look in comparison to the planet and everything. So I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and for me, like as a Seven nerd, the stuff that I loved about Gungaga as well is how it fleshed out the world. Like Gungaga in the original game was actually an optional area entirely, and if you went there, you would learn a little bit more about who Zack is and his parents, and there was an optional fight with the Turks. But instead, they really unpack, you know, Cloud and Tifa's relationship. You see a bit more of the Zack stuff being teased. They bring in Cisne, who's a character from Crisis Core, which people were kind of hoping we'd see from her again, because we'd never seen her outside of Crisis Core, even though canonically she was still alive. So it was really cool for them to bring her back. And then some of the side quests even flesh her out some more and sort of learning about that. And then also, yeah, with the Tifa and the live stream stuff, it's a really cool way of sort of teasing what's going to come in part three. Because there's a lot of important stuff with Tifa and Cloud in the live stream. And so kind of seeing that early, the seeds being planted there. And then, yeah, like you said, just that scene of Cloud going crazy was insane. Like that was, again, that was something that I think the remake series has done so well and fleshing out from the original game is showing Cloud's like descent into madness, basically, and just how he just basically snaps just like that and becomes like Sephiroth, and now he's dodging the bullets and has the blood on his face. Like, it was so well done. And yeah, like Klein said, I was literally on my seat, the edge of my seat the entire time. I'm like, I can't believe this is happening. They unfortunately spoiled a lot of that scene in the final trailer, so I'm glad that I didn't watch it until I'd already beaten that part of the game in the state of play, which is, Square has this bad tendency of spoiling way too much in the final trailers of their games. So for part three, we need to stay away from a lot of those trailers. But yeah, that
Gungaga also gives me my favorite side quest, which is the chicken side quest in the whole game.
it's so funny.
I had to spoil it for Tom just because it was so hilarious. And you're taking these chickens back, and then she's naming them, and then you eat them. And it's like, oh my, just like, it is, it's, this game is so hyper serious in so many moments, and then it isn't. And then it is incredibly silly, and it plays with that sense of humor, which I love, this like, this dichotomy of this like Shakespearean over drama, like craziness with Sephiroth and all of that, and multiple realities and all this crazy stuff with like chicken jokes. Like, I think it is so funny. The last chicken that you go to get, I can remember walking behind it and seeing it go, and I'm like, I'm gonna have to take it all the way back there. This is ridiculous. And then they again play with your expectations, and you get there, there's a boss fight, and then it comes back on its own. I just like, that was my favorite side quest. I don't know if we want to get into that, but like, I think it's just so silly. And I think a lot of the side quests in this game are great and do have like, they have fun, which I like that this game isn't afraid to have fun.
They even play the they even play the like game over theme when the when the chicken is you find out the chicken's dead. It's just, yeah, the little stuff like that, little moments, like it just had me dying. Like, I love that.
I think like that, because you told me before I played that one that they like their fate of what happened to them. But like as I was playing it, because you control it like you're pulling like a can or something that the chicken likes, and it follows the can.
I hate that
and
can.
I found that like mechanic so frustrating. I was like, I don't care if they die. I don't care that they get killed at the end of this, because they deserve it. You know, they're ungrateful.
Yeah, it's a delicate dance pulling that can away. So you gotta be, you think you've got it figured out, and you're like, no, I've got to do it like exactly this way, or they're not following me. Were there any other side quests that you guys wanted to shout out that you liked a lot? I really liked the gym side quest as well. I thought that was just really silly, where you show up and it's just a bunch of beefheads who are like, like, come and help us, and then you've got to do a workout competition against them, and it's just like, this is weird, but I'm here for it. Like, I like it a lot.
I hate those crunches.
The ab crunches killed me. Like, I was there for so long.
I found if you turn, you mute the TV, mm-hmm. I found for some reason easier. I could do it way easier.
Well, yeah, you have to do it on like the hardest difficulty for the platinum. And so what I did, because I was following like trophy guides and some suggestions from people. Yeah, you mute the sound, you mute the music, and you actually hide, like put a towel or something over the scores, just so you can purely focus on nailing the rhythm, because it's so hard. Like, if you mess up once, it's over. The person that you're Jules, the final boss of that mini game, automatically gets like 50 squats no matter what, so you have to top that, and if you mess up once, it's over. So yeah, it was really difficult.
Yeah, it's so tough, because that's also, they have a similar one in Remake. Yeah. I think this one's way harder than that one. Yeah, in terms of side quests, like the one that stood out for me throughout the whole game is the dog mission, where you have to escort Salmon and like, purely because, again, like the music for that, like, it's bit, I think it's using one other quest maybe, but like it's mostly just for this one. It's such a weird song,
bow,
but
wow,
it's
wow.
Like
bow wow wow really,
bow, there you go. Honestly, I've been listening to it on repeat like since playing it, because it's like really catchy. But yeah, like that one I really liked. I also really liked the one where you meet the kids in like the back alleyway, and they turn you into a frog, and then you basically have to do like a Fall Guys-esque so mini funny. Game as a frog. It's so wild. I think those are two of my standouts.
That frog mini game was one of the moments where throughout my playthrough, Gabby would come in and out of the living room and like see these incredible like anime-esque battles and this like these amazing story moments, and then she walked in one day and I'm a frog jumping over hoops, and she's like, what is this video game? Like, what are you playing? Oh man, yeah, that the frog one got me too. It's again just like this, the sense of humor, and it's on display like throughout. It's not just in the side quests, it's in the main story. Like, shout out to the parade sequence, because I think that is so incredibly silly, but so serious. Like they know it's a joke, but they take it so seriously. And I love it. I love like recruiting the guys and they're all like, yes, Cloud. Like they just, they're all in. But yeah, were there any side quests for you, Brad, that stood out?
Yeah, I love a lot of them. I think the whole structure of it where they're tied to a specific character generally is a really smart move because it keeps them sort of focused. And in Remake, some of the side quests were not bad because they sort of fleshed out Midgar and the inhabitants, but a lot of them felt kind of like repetitive and like, oh, go find three cats for Wedge sort of thing. So I like that this was a lot more character focused. They felt really like short stories with each character, which was really nice. Yeah, I was actually going to say the dog one because it really does encapsulate everything I love about this game. On the one hand, like you said, it is silly. There is this like pop song for this dog. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's actually Shinra propaganda, which is hilarious. It's like saying the two best things in the world are this dog and Shinra, which is funny. So, and then it's an escort mission, which when you first hear, oh, you have to bring this dog all the way across Junon, I'm like, ugh, this is going to be tedious. But first of all, the dog runs super fast. So it's not one of those sort of, oh, the NPC moves really slowly and you have to follow it, which is nice. But then also, yeah, besides the sort of fun cutesiness of that all, there's actually like a lot of good story stuff in there. Like I love that Cloud and Barret are sort of having this back and forth where Barret's almost having like an existential crisis about being a father. And he's concerned about, you know, the sort of empty nest thing with a parent. Like eventually, you know, Marlene's going to leave and it's going to hit him even harder because he's a single father and he's kind of struggling with that. And there's that really nice moment where Cloud sort of like gives him some encouragement, you know, savor the time you have with her left, which is sort of a major theme of the game for me. When you talked about like hanging out with the characters, Costa del Sol and everything, it's all about spending the time with these characters because we don't know what's going to happen to them. Like we didn't know what was going to happen with Aerith or all these characters. So that sort of, it kind of ties in back to the larger theme of, and then Barret kind of pays it forward by giving advice to the son and the pregnant wife about taking the money and sort of, you know, do right by that kid. So I love that sort of thing, those sort of character moments. And all those side quests are nice because they're not super long. Like, you know, they do feel like that sort of short story element to it. If you want like a larger sort of layered, multifaceted side quest, that's what the Proto Relic stuff is for. And there's a lot of great stuff in there as well. But like the sort of like smaller character moments are in a lot of those smaller side quests, which I really liked.
Yeah, and I mean, shout out to Queen's Blood. We've talked about it so many times, but like, I guess we could consider that a side quest. But just, I need more of that game. Like, I need a Queen's Blood game yesterday. I really, really took a liking to the actual like deck building of it and playing it. And then it just so happens that it's also got the, like really just like mind-bendingly fun story consequences as well, which I really, really dig.
Yeah, I think like it's crazy because like once you kind of, and I tried to experiment a bit more as I got more cards and you get like different abilities with Queen's Blood and that sort of stuff, but you do kind of get into like a kind of rhythm with like the cards that you're familiar with, but there's just so many that they kind of throw at you, so it is kind of almost a shame that there isn't like a separate mode or like something else that you can take all of this stuff and like put it towards, because yeah, like you said, Klein, I'd love a separate game, because it like, yeah, it's wild too, because like I didn't expect this game to this side quest to go the way it does, because then like Vincent like just randomly shows up and like towards the latter half of that pole bit, and like it feels like it actually has some like consequences to it. But yeah, I didn't think I would get invested into a card game as much as I did with Queen's Blood.
Were you hooked as Tom and I were?
Oh man, yeah. I mean, for context, like for Final Fantasy fans, our favorite mini game for most people in the whole series is Triple Triad, which is a card game from Final Fantasy VIII. It's so popular that they even added it to FF14, the MMO. So there's a lot of like lineage there in the series. So I didn't know what to expect going in, and yeah, I was completely blown away how fun Queen's Blood is, how much depth there is to it. Especially, I think there's something like 160 plus cards, something like that. But you know, as you're doing all the side quests, when you're going for the platinum and you have to do all the like challenges and like the Costa del Sol and the Gold Saucer, where it's very much like a puzzle where you have to figure out the sort of right combination of cards, or then there's like a survival mode at the end where you have to get X a number of points in five rounds, and you have limited cards as you go, sort of thing like that. The little gameplay gimmicks they add to it really show you how in depth this mode is. And then, like you said, how there's a whole story behind it too. The whole side quest with the mystery of the creator of Queensblood, and it's almost like a horror story. And yeah, a bunch of characters from the campaign show up. You have Vincent towards the end, which was really cool. It's so good, and I would not be shocked if they do something with it in between now and the third game, which presumably is 3 years away at least. Like, it would be a huge missed opportunity if they don't release that as its own thing or whatever they do with it. But yeah, the people have spoken. We need more Queensblood.
And it's got, you know what, banger music. Yes. Again, just another great track. And I found this out after playing the game, but I didn't realize that when the advantage is in your favor, like when you are winning, the music changes, and then when you're losing, it changes to a different track. And there's so many bespoke musical touches just throughout this game, whether it is a pop song about chasing a dog and only used in that sequence. But I think the Queensblood music is really good. My favorite song overall, it's so basic, but I had no connection to the Final Fantasy VII theme coming into this. Give me that battle theme all day long. I know it is just like this epic version of the Final Fantasy VII main theme, but I love it. I've listened to it while I'm working. Basically any take on the main theme in this, I just think the battle theme is the most epic and grandiose. It is so, so, so good. And being I love music in film, I love music in games. I think this game's soundtrack is definitely up there for me as one of the best I've ever played, with Persona 5 or other things like that when it comes to great music. But Brad, was there any music for you that you wanted to shout out?
That was the one I was actually going to highlight as well. The main theme is one of my favorite themes in gaming, and just hearing all the ways that these guys take those classic Uematsu themes and repurpose them. Like the fact that there are so many different versions of the battle theme and they all sound great. Like you would think it would be repetitive, but no, they always find a way to take a different genre twist on it, a different sort of style or tone to it. And yeah, that battle theme.
How many times you hear that do, 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 do motif.
Yeah,
throughout the game. It has to be hundreds of times and in 50 different styles. I was just looking at the soundtrack yesterday getting ready for this, and it's the Grasslands, that theme is just the Final Fantasy theme with a different orchestration. The battle theme, it is throughout this game, and it never gets old.
Yeah, and we're praising that battle version of the main theme, which they use in the very opening area of the open world, which you're in very briefly, and then it changes later. So, but that speaks to the sort of care and love that they put into this soundtrack, where every moment, big or small, gets that sort of consideration. We were talking about the stamp theme or salmon theme with the dog. That is a very one-off side quest. They gave a normal version and a battle version of that pop song. I think of Gus, the prison slumlord. He's the most minor character in the original game, and in this game he's essentially the same, very minor. They give him this entire funky soundtrack. It's a total vocal ensemble. It's incredible. And he's a character who maybe has 5 minutes of screen time total, but that's the sort of love and care that they put into this. Every character, every moment gets that theme, that sort of attention. And it's 400 plus songs in this soundtrack, and that the care was put into all of them. I'll also give a shout out as well. Again, sort of basic, but I love the main theme, not of Final Fantasy VII, but the main theme of this game, No Promises to Keep. They got Lauren Elred, the Greatest Showman singer, to do it, and she's got a lovely voice. And for me, it kind of goes back to the sort of golden era of Final Fantasy, the PS1 era, where all those games had those vocal main themes. 8 had Eyes on Me, which was sung by Fei Wong, famous Asian actor and singer. FF9 had Melodies of Life, and then FF10 on the PS2 had Suteki Dane. So they all had these really beloved vocal songs, but 7 actually never had that. It had One Winged Angel, but that was a boss theme, not a main theme sort of thing, and that was more to hype you up. But so I love that they have Uematsu involved, first of all, because it would feel wrong if he wasn't involved in some capacity. And I love that he's contributing the main themes to each of these games. And he's already said he's going to do the third one, which I'm super happy about. And I just love that it's this very touching sort of ballad between Aerith and Cloud. And the fact that in the in-story reason is she just writes it on a whim before the date night. and then performs it live in front of everyone. And then there's that incredible moment where everyone in the crowd is cheering. You see Biggs, Wedge, and Jesse from the live stream cheering her on, which made me start sobbing so much. I was not expecting that. Aerith herself starts crying. It's just such a beautiful song. And then they reprise it in full at the end in the credits. And it's just, man, I can't say enough about the music in this game. Like, I can't wait to see what they're going to do in part three.
That whole sequence was wild. Like, when you show up and you're like, what's happening? It felt very Honey Bee Inn from Remake, where it's like, what's going on? Oh, we're doing this. Like, this is just, we're putting on a full stage production right here with this bespoke, beautiful vocal track. And like, I'm like, this, yep. Like, I'll, sure, this game has everything. Tom, was there any musical motifs or songs that you really enjoyed that we haven't shouted out?
Oh, yeah, I'll mention a couple. I think, well, speaking of Chapter 12, the Gold Saucer, like, I guess, date remix, that's like a lo-fi beats to chill and study to, like, remix of the different character themes when you first meet them. That I've been listening to that on repeat. Like, it's really just, like, because they do it for every different character, depending on who you get paired up with, whether it's Tifa or Aerith or Barret or whatever. And it just, it's like, it literally is like a lo-fi beat of the character themes. I think it's pretty cool. Another one was the Turks theme that they remix in the battles with, it was with the Turks at the end of the game, like Sung and Reno and Elena and, I'm forgetting Rude. The other guy at the moment, but Rude, there you go. And yeah, that like really amped up those fights like extremely well. I just love that. Made me appreciate the Turks theme a lot more. And then the other one was the Genova Emergent yes. theme. I mean, I love how that theme culminates in the first Remake game. Like, it slowly builds as you're fighting Genova. But in this game, like, it starts off with, like, a remix of Aerith's theme, and then it goes into the Genova theme, and it, like, it just, it's kind of incredible, like, how they managed to do that as the battle goes on. So I was really impressed with that, and made me, like, really appreciate that boss fight. And, yeah, I think those are the main ones. I already mentioned the Mount Corel theme. Even, like, the one, the music as you're in the very first chapter of the game, as you're kind of climbing Mount Nebel,
yes,
when you're with Sethros, like that music and that is so damn good. So I mean, yeah, the takeaway is that the music is good. Like, it's incredible. Like, I really hope they've released the first game's music on streaming services. So I really hope that they release this soundtrack soon, because I'm like dying to like listen to it even more.
Square is one of the few publishers who's like pretty good at putting out their stuff on streaming. Like, they have quite extensive collections of like Final Fantasy games and Kingdom Hearts and all their titles on Spotify, Apple Music. So I would expect it soon. I know some of them are up right now, right, Brad?
Yeah. So it's, you can buy it on iTunes. Like, I bought it, but they do that thing, which I think other people do as well, but it's not the full soundtrack. Like, it's missing some songs. Like, they're going to do like a plus version later on, sort of thing, which includes more of the songs sort of thing. But yeah, there's some of them on there, but yeah, I'm a sucker. I bought it. I just wanted to have it.
Of course you did.
Yeah. So it's,
and when it comes to vinyl, I'm sure you'll buy that as well. And every format you possibly can have it in. We talked a bit about the boss themes. I want to talk about the boss fights themselves, because I think that this game, it has a lot of them. There are a lot of bosses. Were there any for you guys that were particularly maybe difficult or standouts or your favorite? There is one dangerous beast. I'm forgetting. What are the little frogmen in Final Fantasy names that can... Tonberries. There's a Tonberry rare beast fight, and that might be the hard, like, for me, that was like, I'm just cheesing this. I'm just picking Barret and Yuffie and sitting in the back corner and just range attacking until this thing dies. That was for me probably the hardest boss fight. One of my favorites was the twin walls that you fight in Temple of the Ancients with like the beast Demon on either world. Side. Yeah, I think like that was just such a unique. I love these like unique boss mechanics, and I know Final Fantasy is famous for a lot of them. Like, I love having this like kind of like barrage on two sides of you coming at you. But yeah, the Tonberry fight was just like, I have to do what? I didn't understand. I'd never experienced a Tonberry before, and so I didn't quite understand what I was doing wrong when I started, and I just walked up to him as Cloud and just wham, dead. And I'm like, what did I do? But Brad, for you, were there any boss fights that like stood out? And what do you think was the hardest in your opinion? Because there's some difficult ones.
Yeah, I love a lot of the boss fights. They really flesh out the combat. And like you said, they do have some interesting gimmicks. In terms of the hardest ones, I mean, those are all in the legendary challenge missions you have to do. Especially because a lot of those, you have to fight them multiple at a time. Like you have to fight two summons at once, and then you have to do them in a row, and you only heal a little bit in between. So it's really brutal in that way. And you fight like a data version of Sephiroth in the final round of the legendary Chadley missions. And he basically every like few, like 30 seconds, just like makes your entraps your party in this like sphere. And then he pulls them all together and just Octa slashes them. So it's like, it's just a lot of like cheap BS in some of those fights. But in terms of like the main story, the boss fight I keep coming back to is Galeon Beast, which is Vincent. That was such a cool surprise. That's one of those things that was not in the original game at all. Like you just recruit Vincent, you leave, you try to recruit him. He's like, I just want to sleep. And then you leave. And then he's like, I want to join the party. And that's it. And that's obviously totally optional, of course. But in this game, you actually have to fight him, which was totally unexpected. It's a cool way of like setting up that he is this creature. He has this monster within him. And in the third game, you're going to be able to control that in some capacity, which is a cool way to sort of set that up. But I love that it was just, it came out of nowhere. It's like, it plays this like very haunted, almost like horror movie version of his theme. He's super tough. He's super fast. His design is awesome. Cause in the original game, because there's not a lot of detail, he just kind of looks like a purple, smaller version of the behemoth monster. But in this, he looks super detailed, all the like cracks on his skin and the long hair on his mane and the horns and everything. It felt like playing Final Fantasy Bloodborne for a bit, like this giant creature in the dungeons. And it was just a tough fight. And then, yeah, just setting up, because for context, this is his level one limit break in the original game. Later on, he turns it basically into Frankenstein, Leatherface with a chainsaw, and literally Satan himself as his final limit, basically. Like, he's literally the devil. So just thinking, if this is what they did with his level one limit, just as a boss fight, I can't imagine actually playing as him in the next game, what all those limit breaks are going to look like. So I thought that was super cool. And then I'll just give a quick shout out as well, because it was a redo of the last game, but just seeing Rufus again and fighting him, the sort of taking his amazing theme from the first game, which is already like a mix of the Shinra theme and the battle theme, and then adding like a grudge match sort of vibe to it, like the chants in it. There, you know, I love that he just literally just skydives into the arena and fights you. He's not afraid to like get his hands dirty. He's got such a great back and forth with Cloud where he's like, you know, Cloud's like, oh, you can't bite the hand that feeds you. And he's like, well, yet here you are. Like, I love the little sass between them. Like, they both like that little rivalry between them. It feels like a very sort of like Ash Ketchum, Gary Oak sort of rivalry, which I really like. The sort of snark that they have with each other. So yeah, that was just another one I really loved.
I know a lot of people are calling that fight the big difficulty spike in the game.
That's
the
hard,
Rufus fight.
Especially on hard mode where you only use Cloud, you can't heal properly. It's really tough.
And it comes in a bit of a boss rush too.
Yes.
Like there's like you fight a few things in a row and he's the last one. You think you finished it. Corneo, like there's all these people, and then it's like, boom, here's Rufus to ruin your day. Tom, was there any, you're coming fresh off of it, was there any for you that was like your favorite or were particularly difficult?
Yeah, the Tom Barry one was one that I was going to mention. Like, just the insta-kill is brutal. But even like, because it's part of also like a side quest with Johnny, and you're supposed to get like one of his crowns, and you can either do it, well, you can settle for like a busted up crown, or you can do the harder option and actually steal.
I stole that crown. Yeah. You know I stole that crown.
So did I. So, and I'm glad I did, because it, and I thought that was just a really cool mechanic. At first, like, I beat the Tom Barry King, and I was like, what was I supposed to do? And I ended up with the busted one. So I had to beat him again and steal his crown. But yeah, I thought that was a really fun mechanic. I really like the, we've talked about like the Temple of the Ancients boss fights. I think a lot of those are like some of the standouts. And I really like the Red Dragon one, where, especially like how the mechanic where the Red Dragon, like you basically like spews a bunch of lava on the floor. And if you don't like pressure it enough to like limit that, like it'll just kill you instantly. So I really like that mechanic of like kind of tempering that and like having to figure out how to kind of make sure you don't insta die, which is always fun. but also just, I mean, the Sephiroth fight at the end. It's very like it's very different to like the first remake game, because it's like it's kind of like, it almost reminds me of Ocarina of Time, like the kind of the environment is very like plain, or even Skyward Sword. Like there's not much, it's like it's an empty void that you're fighting Sephiroth in. But like, all you have to do is just wail this guy as much as possible. I found that like that the boss fight's pretty like difficult, especially when you get to a certain point at the end where you have to pressure him, and then like he'll get like stunned, and if you don't kill him within a certain window, you insta die. I didn't know that, so like I thought I'd done everything right, and then he pulls that out and just kills you with the Octa Slash at the very end. And I was sitting there at whatever half two in the morning. I was like, I'm gonna be here all night. I'm screwed. Like I'm never gonna beat this guy.
And then it gives you the 8 different options when you're dead, and you're like, I don't know what option I need to pick to get back directly to where I just was.
It's so weirdly phrased.
Yeah. You can hit one, and you're gonna go back 6 hours. You have no idea.
That was the thing. I was like, because it plays the cutscene beforehand as well. So I was like, oh my god, am I going to fight like all of this again? But luckily, it brought me back to the right position. But that and also just one other small one that I found like weirdly difficult was there's like in the Dust Bowl is like the Beast Battleground where you fight like different enemies. And there's one, I think it's the last like fight in that, and you fight two of Rufus's dogs at the same time. For the longest time, I just couldn't figure it out. I was like, I'm doing something wrong. But eventually I was like, I'm gonna pick Barrett and like tank this. And it worked. But that was those dogs, man. He I don't know where he gets his pets, but don't like him. Don't like him at all.
I also want to quickly shout out Dine, just because I think like story-wise, like I had forgotten that. I had forgotten Dine's in the original, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I'd forgotten that detail from the original, and like getting that like that backstory of Barrett and everything that happened and this relationship and learning Marlene isn't actually his daughter and it's an adopted daughter situation. Like I think story wise that was very, very interesting, and like I love when they tie that gameplay to story. You're not just fighting the thing to fight the thing. And he dies and it's sad. I do want to get into, because Tom, you teed it up perfectly talking about Sephiroth. I want to talk about the ending. I think that this final boss fight and everything that's happening around it is kind of the flashpoint of this game. It's kind of the big sticking point for a lot of people. And I just want to ask, I'll go to Brad first because you're the expert. What's going on?
Yeah. In terms of like the larger story, or just in the purely in terms of the ending with Aerith?
I guess the ending with Aerith, because obviously we get to this big moment, we get to this fight. Aerith dies. Yes, no, she's there. It looks like she's dead. Sephiroth does the thing that I absolutely love. They did it. I just finished Shogun. They do it in Shogun all the time when he flicks the blood off a sword. I love that. And we cut back and forth between reality. We get Cloud back to back with Zack fighting, which I think is just like the coolest thing, because that's the first time he would have seen Zack since Zack died. And and then we end up Sephiroth, quote unquote, defeated for now, whatever. Aerith standing there, everyone else like grieving. They've just seen their friend murdered, I guess. And Cloud just like, okay, let's go. And they're all looking at him like, what the hell, dude? What's going on? So is Aerith dead? I guess is the question I would like to ask you, because that's kind of where this game leads in the original is, it's the most famous video game death of all time, probably. Like, she famously dies, and it broke a lot of, I'm sure, your heart as a young child playing this game for the first time. So is she dead in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth? What is Cloud seeing? What's going on?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because, a lot of people have sort of been coining the term Schrodinger's Aerith. You know, the idea that she's both dead and alive, because the game is so...
Aerith dies in the forest and no one's there to hear it...
Exactly. Yeah, because the game is so frustratingly ambiguous about it. But, I mean, the sort of more popular sort of interpretation of it is, like you said, she is dead in the... because this game is operating with different timelines, right? I use quotation marks there, but it seems like, you know, based on everything we see from the party, you know, grieving her, like you said, even the fact that like they enter, the entire party enters that those battles with a full limit break, except for Cloud, because they all saw Aerith die. They're all pumped and jazzed to fight, you know, to avenge her. And Cloud's just kind of going about it normally. He's kind of got this cold disconnect to it. So yeah, there's definitely that the sense that she did indeed die, at least in that main timeline, and Cloud just isn't able to accept it, which is a really interesting way of approaching the fact that we have talked about, you know, his sort of mental state, and it's going to get even worse going into the third game. He has the full breakdown and sort of, you know, finding himself after that. So tying that into Cloud's arc of, you know, sort of discovering himself, the idea that he thinks he saved Aerith and he didn't actually do that, and that's sort of going to come later. I think that's pretty interesting. They definitely make it really messy because even if we ascribe to the she's dead and everyone knows it except for Cloud thing, there's things like Red 13 senses her presence at the end. There's things like he says, "Are you okay to get back on your own?" Sort of thing. You know, she says goodbye to him afterwards, if he's flying away in the ship, why would she be saying that if she's actually dead? You know, why is in that final fight that Tom was talking about, Sephiroth addresses her and says, "I underestimated you," which again, if this is sort of in Cloud's head, why is Sephiroth talking to her like that? Like, so there's a lot of like sort of conflicting weird things about it like that. But I think the safest explanation, yeah, is that she is dead in the main timeline, but she is alive in some form in an alternate timeline, or by extension, you could just say the life stream, because I think what they're sort of setting up is a sort of, which is thematically consistent with the original game and Advent Children and all the expanded media, where she's kind of like a force ghost, right? Where she is dead for all intents and purposes, but she's kind of living on in the life stream and she's helping in her own way from a distance, but she's not physically there and she can't really, you know, communicate with you or anything like that. I think one thing that will be interesting is how they handle it going in the third game, you know, how they explore that. I think some people have proposed, and I think would be kind of a cool compromise, is if they do sort of like a cyberpunk or Batman Arkham Knight sort of thing, where you see her talking to Cloud or even other members of the party as you're going along, sort of in like a spirit form. So it still keeps her dead, but it's a way of kind of involving her in the story without, you know, undoing that, which I think would be kind of an interesting way of exploring it. But yeah, it comes back to, because the ending is so messy and there's so much going on and they throw so many boss fights at you, and there's the whole Zack of it all, which we can get into, and all this different timeline stuff. It's very messy and convoluted in a way that kind of, regardless of what they're trying to do with Aerith, it kind of messes with that a little bit, which is definitely a sort of a sense of frustration for me, especially because, like you said, this is such a seminal moment in gaming. So many people, especially me, coming from it 20 years later, you know, there's so much anticipation for it, and it feels like they dropped the ball in some ways in terms of that's landing that moment.
Tom, you're obviously feeling very satisfied with the ending, right? You're just sitting here going, I understand it all. I get it. You can see the Matrix.
Well, this is the thing, because I don't think the ending is confusing. I just think it's vague. And this is kind of a point that I saw, like, Cosmonaut Variety Hour, a YouTuber, he brought it up when he was playing it. I watched him play the end of the game. He was like, what? So I think my kind of issue with the ending, it isn't necessarily like the outcome. Like, I think it's fine if, like Brad was sort of saying, if Aerith's now like a force ghost and she kind of just like vibes around the group every now and then and comes in and helps them every now and then from where she is from the live stream, I'm kind of fine with that. I think my issue was kind of with the kind of how her death was handled in the moment, because you obviously see her get, like, you know, Sephiroth goes in for the kill like he does in the original game, and then Cloud blocks it, but then, like, because Sephiroth's ultimate goal, it seems, is like converging timelines, the timelines like converge at a certain point, and it gets to a point where, oh wait, she's actually dead, or maybe she isn't. And that's kind of where my point of contention comes. Like, I almost wish that Square had chosen a path, right? Like, if they wanted to kill her off, like, okay, she's dead, but she still can be around, like, if they wanted to. But I think just because they didn't want to, they wanted to make that moment vague, because I maybe to spur this conversation that we're having right now, like, whether she's dead or not, I think it kind of lessened the impact of her actual death scene. And because you kind of go from that straight into like, oh, we've got to beat this guy up right now because you've potentially killed our friend, or maybe not. And I think, like, I would have rather have been left with, you know, the heartbreak of like, oh, she's dead, or, you know, the triumph of we've changed the timeline now. We've broken through fate as, you know, remake kind of set up, and we actually, like, are allowing Aerith to live, rather than just this kind of like wishy-washy middle ground of like, is she dead? I don't really, wait, what is happening right now? So yeah, I think it really does come down to that moment. Like, I wish that was handled a little bit differently in terms of whether she is dead or not. I think what Brad said makes sense. Like, it's a bit of both. Like, she died, but it's, she's still around. I think it also is, because there is the degradation stuff with Cloud and that sort of stuff, but there's also that moment where Sephiroth basically shows Cloud the multiverse, which I never thought I would say in relation to this series. But I guess Cloud is now at a point where he can see the live stream and that sort of stuff, and that's what maybe has allowed him to kind of gain access to talking to Aerith, whereas the others don't necessarily have that. But yeah, it is, like I said at the beginning, it's tough to judge this when we don't know what, you know, the rest of the story is. Like, it's similar to the second Spider-Verse movie. Like, I love that movie. Like, I really thought it was great, but I think it's difficult to, it'll be interesting to see how that, well, that compares when the third movie comes out. And it's the same with this. I think it'll be interesting to see how we look back on this moment once the third game comes out.
That's a good comparison, because I agree with a lot of what you're saying. It kind of stunts the impact of it now. And I think Spider-Verse is a great comparison, because what I like about that is it is obviously a cliffhanger ending. It is ambiguous in the sense that there's a lot that's going to happen. What's going to happen with Peter, with Miles and alternate Miles and the sort of team saving him and all that. But I feel like that's a good ending because it's very clear. You know what happened. The sort of conversation, the speculation is just what's going to happen next, but it's very clearly told. I feel like the problem with Rebirth is it's ambiguous, but not necessarily in terms of, oh, this was very clear, carefully written storytelling that sort of leads to that. It's just, no, it's ambiguous because it's very very convoluted and not very well expressed. Like, to your point about the multiverse stuff, I'll just very quickly, one of the big things in the sort of larger lore of Final Fantasy VII is the idea of the life stream. There's like a life stream white and black, and you kind of see that in the Gungaga section, where there's like the two life streams kind of like Dragon Ball Z Kamehameha-ing themselves. And that kind of comes from one of the novellas that was written by Nojima, who wrote the original Seven and Remake and Rebirth. And the life stream white and black, the white sort of relates to Aerith and the black sort of relates to Sephiroth. And it's just sort of short stories sort of examining their relationship to the life stream and sort of exploring how it's not necessarily timelines, but more the life stream energy is basically like, it's a collection of like real things that happened, like memories, and then are sort of unrealized desires. And there's actually like an NPC in Cosmo Canyon that there's a YouTube video of it. If you go and find this person, they're talking about this where, so the idea is that it's not necessarily a multiverse. Like, every time we're seeing an alternate sort of reality, it's more of like a what if scenario. It's basically the planet sort of showing, as this is a desire, either our desire, the planet's desire, or like an NPC's desire, a character's desire sort of thing. Like, even when you're in, and you kind of see that with all the Zack moments, like when you're in the boat and under Cosmo Canyon, Aerith puts her hand in the water and then it cuts to Zack. Or when Cloud goes to sleep, it cuts to Zack. So it's kind of like the live stream sort of showing these sort of unrealized desires of these characters. So when you think of it like that, it's actually like a sort of clever in-universe, simpler take on the multiverse. Just the problem is, again, they don't feel like they explain it well enough. I don't feel like you should have to find an NPC in a town who kind of explains this, or read a book that was written 15 years ago that kind of fleshes this out. It's one of those things where 95% of this game's storytelling is amazing. Same with Remakes, but then there's that 5% at the end, which is just really Kingdom Hearts level nonsense that I wish they sort of simplified.
I think that's why I liked it. Like, I think, I think the complicated nature of it is why I really connected with the ending and with just, like, the confusion of it all. And I want to get into Zach, because you mentioned him. And the way that this game opens and then cuts back and forth throughout the game, I'm thinking, have what I have played from Remake, what's real and what isn't? What is the quote-unquote Omega timeline? What is the main... thinking Marvel here, like the main timeline that everything else is happening and everything branches off of, is Zach's like world the world in like is that this Omega timeline? Obviously, we open the game and Aerith and Cloud and everyone's being carted off on gurneys, and it's like what the hell's going on? And then at the end of it, Zach goes back and he ends up somewhere. So I want to know what the two of you think is going on with Zach. How's he going to play into this going forward, and where do we leave him at the end of this game? Like, is he going to be, I thought he was going to be a party member by the end of this thing. For just some reason, I thought, like, that's the way you look at the image, the like key art for this game. It's Sephiroth, Cloud, and Zach, all three of them together. What do we think happens with Zach moving forward? And what do you think about how we kind of wrap up his thread at the end of this thing, Brad?
Yeah, I feel like he was really misused in this game. Like, I really liked his character in Crisis Core, but going back and replaying the remaster, there's a lot of problems with that game's story, especially how it relates to the larger universe. And one thing that Crisis Core doesn't really grapple with is Zack is basically a war criminal, right? He, like, literally one of the early missions in that game is he invades Wutai, which is Yuffie's home, and he's killing a bunch of soldiers. And Yuffie even alludes to that in her date scene. She says she has a crush on this guy, and it's very clearly she's talking about Zach, which is kind of weird because he killed all of her people. But that's the sort of thing where they don't really reckon with that. Like, by the end of Crisis Core, he just kind of leaves Shinra, saves Cloud, and then he's a hero. And I feel like Rebirth had an opportunity to sort of explore that. Like, they had the perfect out for that, too. Like, Biggs is alive in that alternate world, and he has a dynamic with Zach, and I thought that would be a really cool way to sort of the two of them, because Biggs has a lot of blood on his hands too. He's an eco-terrorist, so I thought that would be a really cool way of the two of them sort of, you know, we've done a lot of like pretty bad stuff in our past, you know, we want to do better. That would have been a really cool dynamic, but they don't really do anything with that. And then there's Zach is so inconsequential to the larger story that if you play the game again, there's an option to turn off his sequences, so it just skips them. So that's how
and he just shows up in the final battle.
Like, he can literally be removed from the story, and then he just shows up for the final battle, right? And I think if you add up all of his scenes, it's maybe less than an hour. So I just feel like I do like the character, despite some of the problems with his writing, but I just feel like there was an opportunity to do more with him here. And like Tom said, there's obviously a third part. They're going to do more with it. But the fact that he's literally on the cover of this game, the game opens and ends with him in a lot of ways. You know, you would expect him to have more of a prominent role, and he doesn't have that. So it just feels like a missed opportunity. And then, yeah, him coming, like you said, Klein, that whole fight with him is really cool from a gameplay perspective. But I feel like it doesn't really feel earned yet. I feel like Cloud should... if they want to do a sort of reunion with Cloud, this kind of cheapens it now because they've already met again, right? Like, I feel like there could have been a really cool emotional reunion there in the third game that's a little squandered now because they've met already. And I was also, it also just kind of boils down to them kind of going overboard with these endings. Like, we fought Sephiroth twice now at the end of these games. Like, in the original game, he was sort of a background presence. So by the time you got to the final fight, you know, you fight Bizarro Sephiroth, which they included in this game too, which is weird. And then you fight Safer Sephiroth and One Winged Angel starts playing. There's a buildup to it and it feels incredible. But now I question what they're going to do with that because we've already fought him so many times. I feel like this game should have just had Jenova boss fights at the end and that's it. And maybe Sephiroth can still be there, maybe talking to you, sort of like the Joker in Arkham Asylum, like you hear his voice as you're fighting, but you're not actually fighting him because, yeah. So I think just they did too much with Cloud, with Zach and Sephiroth towards the end of this that I don't know what they're going to do in the third part. But I think going forward, I mean, they're very ambiguous about which timeline Zach is in. I think to me, I think he's in our timeline. I think that just makes the most sense. And then he'll eventually reunite with Cloud and the party, of course. But the big question with him is whether he actually lives this time or he dies again, because I mean, you know, his death was a very important part of Cloud's arc, and in the original game Tifa was very much a the reason that Cloud gets to sort of find himself. So I'm a little worried just if they include too much Zack there, where it takes away from Tifa, because that is very much her story moment, her glory, her moment to shine. So I hope they don't go too overboard with that.
You do say Zack was maybe a little unneeded, but he does get my favorite moment in the game, which is when he's talking to the conversation with Marlene.
The two of them
talking, and she's like, "Don't let her wake up. The man will kill her." And I just love that. Like, I'm just like, yeah, like, yeah, he is. I don't know.
I mean, he has one of my favorite lines where in those final boss fights, he literally says, "What the hell is even going on?" Because he's literally the audience surrogate right there. It's like they knew that it's just a complete nonsensical moment right now. And he just sort of says what the audience is thinking, which I loved.
Tom, did you like Zack's inclusion in this, especially coming off like the ending of Remake was such a big deal with Zack? I didn't know who Zack was at the ending of that game, and I had to listen to podcasts. It's like, oh, that's really cool. Like, we have broken the timeline, we have changed fate, and he's shown up. But has he? We're still wondering that question.
I kind of agree with Brad. Like, as we were going through the game, I was like, okay, we're seeing these like cuts to every now and then, but we're not really getting a lot of this guy. But I think it culminates in a really cool moment. Like, I mean, just the way that Zack plays, I really like his like limit breaks and his synergy ability. I think they're really cool. But I do feel like his inclusion here does feel like quite fan servicey, and it's almost like they're like, oh, well, we're just going to throw him in here just for the sake of it. And it feels like they didn't really know what to do with him. I think a lot of it is to do with pacing, because you see him like at the very start of the game, and then a number of chapters go by, and then he's back, and then number more chapters go by, and then it's like he's back again, and then it's like you see a bit more of him like a bit rapidly, and then he's gone again. And then I think just the way they could have, if we had a bit more time with him, like Brad was saying, like, and fleshed him out a bit more, I think his inclusion here would be a bit more justified. But I just don't think they get him to do that all too interesting stuff. I think they could have taken a different direction with what they included him with. If that was going to be like, let's just incorporate him into this main story now and he's alive and he's here, I think that could have shaken things up and been a bit cooler. But it like was similar to the ending. Like, it was just kind of like vague and weird for a while. I think like the end goal was cool, but I think it could have been handled a bit better. In terms of Brad's point about Sephiroth, like, I do agree. I think like I really like Tyler Hoechlin's like performance of Sephiroth. I think he's really like got the gravitas, and like his performance is really great. But like, we've beat this guy's ass like twice now, so it's kind of it does limit his level of threat. Like, we kind of, well, yeah, we've beaten him like twice, so I don't really see the kind of imposing villain that he's kind of set up to be in like the original game, and I wish they kind of had held back a little bit maybe and decided like, we're actually gonna, yeah, you're not gonna get Sephiroth at the end of this game, but you bet it's gonna be like a big brutal battle in the third one. And yeah, like I said, I did like the Sephiroth fight. I thought it was cool, I think, but I do wonder the reasoning. Like, he hasn't really, like, yeah, he's just not posing as much of a threat as I think he could have in the grand scheme of things.
Could that be because he's just thrown away as a pawn sometime in the third game, and it's Genova who's like the fine? I don't know. That's kind of the way that I came out of it, thinking, oh, is he getting played by some bigger force?
So yeah, the original game was a little convoluted, partly for translation reasons, and also just, yeah, some of the storytelling wasn't the best in that sense. But yeah, they have confirmed since that, even if it wasn't entirely clear in the original game, Sephiroth is controlling Genova. It's not the other way around. So he ultimately has full control over her. So every time she's popping up in his form, that's him from his little cocoon in the northern crater. He's pulling all the strings there. And yeah, overall, I like how they Sephiroth is more involved in the story, because a lot of people don't realize that he is a very psychological villain in the original game. He is sort of messing with Cloud a lot of the time. And so they really lean into that in a lot of ways in this game. Like going back to chapter 13, where he's like whispering Cloud's ear, he like gives him that creepy hug. And he's talking about like, oh, he makes you relive Jesse's death. And he's like, you don't care about her. You didn't even cry. Like, I love that sort of stuff. It's a good way of giving him more of a role. It's just, I don't feel like he needed to actually be a physical threat again in this game. They should have just saved him. So yeah, I agree with you.
Where do we go with the third game? And what I mean by that is, what most importantly, because Tom, you don't know the story of Final Fantasy VII original, so you probably have no idea where it's going to go next, but what is it called? What is this, as we kind of close down here, what are we calling this third game? We've had Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, we've had a remake. What's the third one going to be called, Tom?
It's going to be called Final Fantasy VII Rising Revengeance. That's going to be the official name of it. No,
Platinum Games is going to develop it. It's going to be great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. Like you said, I'm not as familiar with the latter third of the story in comparison to you guys. There is a lot of talk of reunion, but like, Crisis Core is also the remake, is that's called Reunion, so I don't know if they'd want to step on that game's toes. I don't know, what do you guys think? I've really not got any like really good ideas.
I have one that I've settled on for the past year that I really like. I like Requiem because it has the sort of sense of finality to it. It literally means like a mass for a dead person, so in a literal sense it could refer to Aerith if she stays dead, or just the sort of characters and the death of the planet as a whole, you know, people on the planet, but also in like a more meta sense, it's sort of like they're gonna still do FF7 stuff after this, of course, but this is likely the last big project that the original team is gonna work on. Like even Katase, who directed the original 7 and is a producer on these games, he gave an interview recently and he said this is probably gonna be his last 7 project because of just his age. And even if Square continues, because they're gonna want to do it, this is very much the original team working on this game, Nomura, Katase, Nojima, etc., saying goodbye to 7 in a lot of ways. You would imagine that's what it's going to be. So I think Requiem kind of works on that level as well, where it's sort of a farewell to from that old guard to this universe, these characters. And it also means rest, right? Like just the sense that, oh, the characters are finally going to get a rest, whether in a literal sense that they're dead or just, you know, figuratively that they can finally, whoever lives or dies at the end, you know, they're done fighting. So I love that. I like that. I think it sounds cool as well. So.
Yeah, I've never thought of Rec Room, but that sounds awesome. Like I can see that sounds like such a Final Fantasy name or a Square Enix name, because they are known for some
random
great
Latin
titles.
Words. Yeah,
exactly. The two that I was thinking of, and I don't know how it would play into the story, I just think it sounds really cool, would be Resurrection, just like Final Fantasy VII Resurrection, especially if Aerith comes back in some form later in the game. I think that could work really well. But other than that, I wish they had held Reunion. Like, I wish they had held Reunion for this. It would have worked perfectly for a third game and called Crisis Core something else. Maybe
and
they
Reunion,
just call it Remake 3.
Yeah, and Reunion doesn't really have any sort of narrative or thematic significance to Crisis Core. It's literally just because it's a remaster is why they called it that, which is funny because, yeah, there's literally no other significance to it. So, yeah, if they should have saved Reunion as well. But yeah, if they don't do that, I vote for Requiem. I know some people have even suggested like Return or Returns, like the Dark Knight Returns. I don't know if I like that. Final Fantasy VII Returns, that sounds kind of silly.
It already returned. It's returned a few times.
Yeah. So
is there anything else that you guys want to quickly shout out before we finish this up?
Do we just want to quickly talk about favorite characters to play as? Because obviously we got some new ones in this game that we didn't play as before, but I guess I'll just go quickly. Like, I didn't play Integrate, like the DLC mission with Yuffie, but like playing as Yuffie in this game she's really fun.
I love Yuffie. I just like Yuffie's character. This teenage fangirl. She's excited to be along for the ride.
Honestly. I like how... I just love how quick she is. Like, her blindside ability, I found it really... just when you stack that up with a like doppelganger, and you have two Yuffies now, so double the fun. And you're just like building up your ATB with that. I thought that was really fun. And I also like how they kind of improved Aerith in this game. I didn't love how Aerith played in the first game. But they've added like a couple different abilities, like her different wards. So she's now a bit more, she can raise ATB a bit more quickly. And I thought she was a lot of fun. But what about you guys? Brad, who's your favorite in this game?
Yeah, I mean, I really loved Yuffie. I did play Integrate, of course. I like how they sort of added some of the moves like Doppelganger. I think for me, I was really pleasantly surprised with Red 13 because going in, I wasn't sure how like a four-legged creature would feel. Like even like my only frame of reference in terms of Square Enix games is like Kingdom Hearts 2, where you play as like Lion Sora, which was fun, but it was a little floaty. So I kind of like how Red 13 feels a little more grounded and tightly to control. And I like that he's a tank character in a lot of ways. Like he's all about sort of taking damage and filling up like a rage mode. But then I like that there's sort of like a risk reward mechanic with that, where you sort of have to decide on the fly. Do I want to, you know, use the rage mode to sort of buff out Red 13 and go ham on the enemy, or sort of use my meter to buff my party? Like I can heal them or I can cast haste on them. So I like that sort of back and forth with those moves.
I was a big fan. My party the whole game essentially was Tifa, Aerith, and Cloud. I really like how Tifa plays. Like I love being able to get some air control and the synergy abilities with Cloud, where you can throw her upwards towards things. And I think that just she was a great, her and Cloud and Aerith were like a great trio that the way I had them built just like played off of each other very well, where it was like Aerith was healing and building ATB while Tifa was like really good at pressuring enemies, and then Cloud would come in and just do these crazy limit breaks and crazy synergy attacks to deal a lot of damage. I know this might be unpopular. In the original Final Fantasy, the second I unlocked Caite Sith, I played through the rest of the game with Caite Sith in my party as much as I possibly could. I think he's silly. I think his moveset is very dumb, but I enjoyed playing it. And I liked playing Caite Sith in this game as well. It's the randomness, which I think can turn a lot of people off, I did actually enjoy quite a bit. And I think they tone it down a little bit here. I do feel, I felt like I had a little bit more control over what was actually going to happen with Caite Sith in this game compared to in the original, where a lot of it is just rolling dice. But I think Caite Sith just as a character, it's one of my favorite things about Final Fantasy, is you can have a character that looks like Cloud standing beside a character that looks like Caite Sith. And they both look like they're from completely different universes, but it cohesively makes sense in this world. So shout out to Caite Sith. I can't wait to play for as Vincent. Like that's just, I hope we get to play as Cid too.
Oh, we will for sure. And to me, that's actually what I talked about being hyped for Vincent, but I'm also really hyped with Cid. I was a little disappointed with how they used him in this game. We don't need to get into that. He's obviously going to have a much bigger role in the next one. And Dragoons are my favorite class in any Final Fantasy. I love the just sort of spear-wielding knight who's all about jumping around and everything. And that's the class that Cid is based on. So I love the idea of using that in remake-style combat and just how they're going to incorporate some of his limit breaks. Like his final limit break in the original game is he literally calls in his airship to do an airstrike on the enemy. So like... or like what he uses, a stick of dynamite that he lights with his cigar and then just throws it at the enemy. So there's a lot of fun stuff they can do with him, especially with the synergy abilities and how he'll interweave with the other characters. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they do those, both of them, him and Vincent.
Don't know if you caught this at the very end of the game, Cid whistles the Final Fantasy yes. ending theme, which is yes. like, I just like, they didn't have to do that, but they did. And I appreciate it. You, dear listener, what did you think of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth? We've come to the end of the spoiler cast, but you can let us know what you thought about the podcast, the game, everything over on Twitter @controller_club, Instagram @controllerclubpod, and TikTok controller.club. Rate, review us wherever you get your podcasts, 5 stars. It really helps out. And send in any questions, topic ideas, or just simple hellos to controllerclubpod@gmail.com. Brad, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people keep up with all the wonderful things you're doing? And do you have anything exciting coming up in the hopper?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I could talk about Remake, Rebirth, anything Seven for hours. So I appreciate you guys putting up with my fanboyism. I'm all my stuff's on mobilesyrup.com. And you can find me on the socials at Brad Shankar, BradShankar. In terms of stuff I'm working on, not a whole lot right now. It's kind of a quieter period, and we unfortunately did have a few layoffs recently, so it's kind of dealing with the fallout of that. But I am excited because next month I am going to Summer Game Fest again, which is really cool. So I'm planning a lot of things for that. Still trying to iron stuff. Xbox just announced their showcase a few days ago. So and then Ubisoft has a bunch of stuff that they're not haven't talked about yet. So yeah, really excited to go to that. So I'll have lots of stuff coming up from that.
Awesome. And Tom Drew, where can people keep up with you?
Yeah, you can find me at Tom Drew Art on Instagram and Twitter. I posted some Justice League artwork. If you want to check that out, if you're a fan of the cartoon, check that out. And I've got some Final Fantasy VII artwork in the hopper as well. So if you've gone to the end of this and you're like, I need some FF7 artwork in your life, then go check it out over there.
Fantastic. And Tom, you're going to be away for a couple of weeks. So where are you going? It's going to hurt me where you say you're going, but where are you going and how long are you going to be away?
Yeah, so I'm going to be going to a little place called Toronto, Canada.
Hey!
I'll be there for 2 weeks. It should be fun. Obviously, won't be able to... I'll see if I can get the hotel Wi-Fi running. We'll see how it could work, but might not be on a couple episodes. I'm sure Klein and Lauren will hold down the fort okay. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll see you back just in time for Summer Games Fest, just in time for, I'm hoping the week you come back, we'll get a PlayStation showcase and then we'll just roll right into Summer Games Fest and the rest of the year will be awesome. You can keep up with me everywhere. I'm at The Kleinfelt, TheKleinfelt. And that is going to wrap up this episode of Controller Club. I want to thank you so much for listening. Let's get gaming.